Before we begin today's testimony, I see Dr. Rodier is back in the witness chair. Do we know yet what the general schedule is with Dr. Goodman?
Yes, sir. He's going to be available this morning. So we anticipate as soon as Dr. Rodier's testimony is done, we'll move on to, with a short break to make the change, we'll move on to Dr. Goodman.
Very good. Anything we need to take care of before we get
not
on?
Not from the petitioner, Special Master.
Nor from the government, sir.
Okay. Very good. With that, Dr. Rodier, you've been sworn. You're back in the witness chair. Mr. Johnson, please continue with your examination.
Thank you, Special Master. Good morning, Dr. Rodier.
Good morning.
We made it through some of your qualifications yesterday.
Intercall operator, are you there?
You're in the room. You're ready to go.
Okay, thank you very much. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you. Dr. Rudy, as I was saying, we discussed some of your qualifications yesterday, but there were just a couple of points that I wanted to get into the record. First, did you receive any honors or awards in connection with your PhD?
Yes, I was lucky enough to be a Woodrow Wilson Fellow, and that was a national competition that paid for your graduate school for a few hundred people in the U.S.
And the second point that I wanted to cover is, do you have any NIH grants?
Yes, I have two.
And what are they for?
They're both for work on autism. The title of the first one, which I've had for 10 years, is Genotype and Phenotype of Brainstem Injury in Autism. And that's a program project grant that involves a number of different universities and some foreign sites. And the second one is called Genotype and Phenotype of Treatments of Autism, or Response to Treatments of Autism. And that's a center grant that provides infrastructure and funds projects in my group at the University of Rochester.
And how much are those grants for, approximately?
About $2.5 million a year.
And do you have anybody working with you on these grants?
Yes, many, many, many people. There are about 30 or 40 people at the MD or PhD level who are supported by those two grants.
And those would be individuals that you are supervising on
yes.
their work in these projects? Dr. Reddy, have you ever testified in a legal proceeding before?
I've testified in writing. I've never testified in person.
Meaning that you've submitted reports or affidavits, but you actually
yes.
haven't testified. What cases have you submitted reports in?
The Canadian omnibus, which was on the same subject as this one, and the Redfoot case last year.
And was that a civil case?
Yes.
And you said you hadn't testified. Is there a reason that you didn't testify in those proceedings?
Both of those cases were dismissed before trial.
Doctor, turning to your second slide, and let me distribute those.
Thank you. I assume we should mark this as respondents. Trial Exhibit 11.
Dr. Rudy, looking at slide 2, can you briefly summarize the opinions that you're going to be giving here today?
Yes, and I should say that we negotiated what I would talk about because there's so many experts, and I didn't want to overlap with what they were testifying about. So I think I'm the only person actually in the country who's ever worked on both autism and mercury poisoning. And so I want to first revisit for you the Bernard paper of 2001, which is the only reason all of us are here today, because it claimed that the symptoms of mercury poisoning were the same as those of autism. And then the second topic that I want to talk about is, when does autism begin? Is it initiated prenatally or postnatally?
And turning to slide 3, Doctor, you mentioned the Bernard article, and for the record, this is Petitioner's Master List number 262. Doctor, to the best of your knowledge, is this article essentially where the hypothesis that thimerosal causes autism started?
Yes.
As a scientist who works in the area of autism, do you have any criticisms of the Bernard paper?
Well, I have many that are shared by scientists who work on autism and scientists who work on mercury. And there's one published article replying to the Bernard article, and it's by two experts on autism, Nelson and Bowman. And what they were criticizing in the article was the selection of symptoms, what the authors called the symptoms of autism, which included so many things that occur in everyone. For example, nausea, vomiting, irritability, temper tantrums. Those are not diagnostic symptoms of autism. They're things that happen to people with autism, but they happen to all of us. So they're not useful either for diagnosis or for comparing autism to other disorders. And they also included a lot of symptoms of autism, as they called them, that were ones that occur in many people and in some cases of autism. So, for example, mental retardation, depression, abnormal gait, these are things that are not normal, like irritability and vomiting, but they occur in many conditions, not necessarily in autism. They're not diagnostic symptoms, and so they can't be used to compare the symptoms of autism to the symptoms of another disorder.
And turning to slide 5, as a scientist who has done research, I'm sorry, slide 4, as a scientist who has done research with mercury, do you have criticisms of the Bernard paper?
Right. When experts on mercury read this paper, what they're struck by is that the symptoms of what they call mercury poisoning have been drawn from cases of exposure to mercury vapor, which causes Mad Hatter's syndrome, and they've been drawn from exposures to inorganic mercury, which causes acridinia, and also from both pre- and postnatal exposures to methyl mercury. But there are very few references to ethyl mercury, which would be the only kind of mercury poisoning that's relevant in this case or to their hypothesis.
Because that's the form of mercury that's present in thimerosal.
That's right.
Doctor, does the Bernard paper provide support for the claim that mercury toxicity and autism share similar symptoms?
No. Well, I mean, it purports to, but I want to show you examples of the kinds of comparisons they're making. And instead of just giving you my opinions, let's just actually look at what they said, okay?
And right now we're referring to slide 5.
Right. So on the first line, mark number 1, you'll see that they say there's similarities in depression, depressive traits, mood swings, flat affect, and impaired face recognition.
And excuse me, just for the record, this is in the Bernard article, which again is Petitioner's Master List 262. It's in Table 1 on Exhibit page number 2. If you can just tell us the significance of these notations.
Well, it's true that depression is a symptom of acridinia, exposure to inorganic mercury. They're depressed because they're so sick and they have terrible pain in their hands and feet. It's true that mood swings are characteristic of Mad Hatter's disease. It's true that flat affect is a diagnostic symptom, actually, of autism. But impaired face recognition does occur in autism. It's never been even tested in any kind of mercury poisoning. So we have four examples here, and there's no overlap. The ones that are characteristic of different kinds of mercury poisoning don't occur in autism, and the ones that occur in autism don't occur in any kind of mercury poisoning. So you might think perhaps they don't really mean that the same symptoms occur, but just that all these symptoms are closely related, and so that means that the symptoms are alike. But that doesn't work either, because depression is not the same thing as mood swings, and flat affect is the opposite of mood swings, and impaired face recognition has nothing to do with mood. So these four things don't go together in any way. And this, I'll just mention some of these others. Verbalizing and word retrieval problems do occur in Mad Hatter's disease, but echolalia and word use and pragmatic errors have never been reported in mercury poisoning. They occur in autism. Echolalia is the tendency to generate speech that's repetitions of things you've heard, for example, radio jingles or songs, or something that someone said to you. So, for example, in one of the cases that we studied at Rochester, a little boy about three decided that he didn't want to be tested anymore, and so he ran toward the door, and his father ran after him and scooped him up and said, "Bet you want to get out of here, buddy." And, of course, that's exactly what he wanted to do. So his father brought him back into the examining area, and he made a couple more escape attempts, but each one he shouted, "Bet you want to get out of here, buddy," as he did it. But he's parroting instead of generating his own language. Word use, there are many classic examples of problems with word use in autism, and they occur even in people with very high-functioning autism or people with Asperger's syndrome who may have normal vocabularies and high IQs, but they use words in odd ways. And the most famous example of this, I think, is a young man who described a hole in his sock as a discontinuity of knitting. So he knows what the words mean, and they're not really inappropriate, but they're not used in the typical way. And, of course, neither of these conditions has ever been reported in mercury poisoning. Then the third list I selected was lacks eye contact. That is a symptom of autism, but not of mercury poisoning. Impaired visual fixation is a symptom of methylmercury poisoning, and it means that the brain control of the eye muscles is impaired, and so the eye muscles aren't adjusting nicely to allow you to fixate on something. Then problems in joint attention occurs in autism, but it doesn't occur, as far as I know, in any kind of mercury poisoning. And it has nothing to do with vision. It's actually an example of a social impairment.
Did the authors of the Bernard paper also attempt to draw comparisons in biological abnormalities?
They did. Okay. And
this is slide six.
So, for example, they pointed out that progressive microcephaly was characteristic of mercury poisoning. That's methylmercury. Prenatal exposure, the children are born with small heads. I wouldn't call it progressive, but progressive microcephaly and macrocephaly, they listed as symptoms of autism. Children with autism occasionally have microcephaly, but they are more commonly characterized by progressive macrocephaly, as we heard yesterday. Macrocephaly, of course, has never been reported in mercury poisoning. Then they list that mercury poisoning causes demyelinating neuropathy. That's a chronic exposure to inorganic mercury does cause that. No one has ever reported that in autism. Then demyelination in the brain, they list as a characteristic of autism. but no one has ever reported that in autism, and the reference they give says nothing about that.
And for the record, those examples were from Table 2 of the Bernard article,
right.
Which is exhibit page number 4 of that article. Doctor, if the authors of the Bernard article are trying to show a connection between thimerosal-containing vaccines and autism, why don't they talk about the symptoms of ethylmercury poisoning?
One might well ask that question. And the answer is that it doesn't make a very good story if you compare the symptoms of autism to the symptoms of ethylmercury poisoning. So on this next slide, I've used an article by Zhang from 1984.
And for the record, that's Petitioner's Master List number 232.
And the reason I picked this article is because Zhang actually had the chance to study 41 people who had all been exposed to ethylmercury from tainted rice. And so they were able to actually calculate how much they'd eaten. They knew what the dose was, in other words. They then examined them, followed the course of their disease, and were able to document their symptoms. And what they did was they actually counted how many of the people had symptom one and how many of the people had symptom two. And the doses in this case ranged from very mild effects to death. And so they had a good range of different levels of symptoms to examine. What they found was that the three most common symptoms were muscle weakness, loss of appetite, and dizziness. Those don't sound much like autism. The next 10 most common symptoms were nausea, abdominal pain and diarrhea, fever, numbness of the extremities, paresthesia and ataxia, vomiting, thirst, unsteady gait, ringing of the ears, and headache. And again, I think you can see that none of these sound like any of the symptoms of autism that are used in diagnosis. So there's really no correspondence between the symptoms of ethylmercury poisoning and autism.
Now, Doctor, the petitioners will argue that they are not claiming in this case that acute mercury toxicity causes autism as hypothesized in the Bernard article. They will claim that their hypothesis is that low levels of inorganic mercury persist in the brain and cause either oxidative stress or an inflammatory process, which results in autism. Does that hypothesis make sense to you?
No, it doesn't. And I think earlier this week, one of the witnesses talked about the fact that scientists make every effort to try to disprove a hypothesis. They don't just look for support for a hypothesis. And at the time that this paper was written, today, there is one piece of evidence that absolutely refutes the hypothesis that inorganic mercury in the brain causes any symptoms. And that is the cases of acute poisoning with ethylmercury that have been documented to cause high, high levels of brain inorganic mercury in autopsy studies. But the people who were subject to those exposures, they occurred in medical accidents and in the case of the tainted pork, which you've probably heard about, the New Mexico pork case. In those cases, even though the people became seriously, seriously ill with very high levels of ethylmercury and corresponding high levels of inorganic mercury after the ethylmercury washed out, they all recovered completely from their neurological symptoms after the ethylmercury was gone and they just had inorganic mercury. They no longer had symptoms.
So the effects went away?
Yes.
Doctor, now I'd like to turn to slide 8 and the next topic that you are going to address this morning, and that's the timing or when autism begins. And in your report, you identify 5 environmental risk factors for autism. Now let's look at slide 9, and you can discuss those.
Surely. The ones I've listed here are ones that come from population studies, and they are exposure to rubella, thalidomide, valproic acid, which is a seizure medication, ethanol, and misoprostol. And to the right, I've listed the time that's the critical period when exposure has to occur for autism to be one of the results. And for rubella, that's before the ninth week after conception. For thalidomide, it's week 3 and 4. Valproic acid, it's week 3 and 4. Ethanol, it's week 3 to 5. And misoprostol, it's week 6.
What can we learn from these studies? Does this mean that all environmental factors, when they're discovered, are all going to share the same period?
It certainly doesn't mean that they have to. Perhaps there are other times when an injury could lead to something like autism. For example, tuberous sclerosis cases don't show autistic symptoms early on, but as their brains become more and more injured from the tumors in their brains, they may show autistic symptoms. So there are probably other ways to produce those symptoms, but I think it's most likely that when, as we find more environmental factors or exposures that are involved increasing the risk of autism, I think it's more likely that they will be in similar periods to this in the first trimester.
Doctor, do you know what terbutaline is?
Yes.
The petitioners have raised the issue of terbutaline in this trial, and I was wondering why you didn't include terbutaline on your list of environmental risk factors.
That's a good question, because it's not, that study is actually a genetic study, the Connors study, and it is not a population study. That is, they didn't go out and find everyone they could who was exposed to terbutaline and then compare the rate of autism in those people to the rate of autism in the general population, as the studies I've listed for you did. What they did instead was look for cases of twins where one had autism. And then they looked in those twin pairs for the ones that had been exposed to terbutaline and the pairs that had not been exposed. And what they were looking for was whether the end result when they, as they grew up, was that both twins had autism or only the one twin had autism. And they were ascertained for one of the twins having autism, remember. When they looked at their whole sample of cases exposed to terbutaline or not in these twin pairs, there was no significant increase in the second twin having autism in the whole set of cases. Then they cut it down another way and looked at a smaller subset, and that was not significant either. They finally cut it down to a very small subset where both of the twins in the pair were male, and they had no affected other siblings. And in that very, very small group, there were more concordant cases exposed to terbutaline. So the implication of that would be that terbutaline might have had an effect on those cases. However, this study suffers from a problem that we have with all studies of things like optimality in delivery or pregnancy, and that is that it's very hard to tell whether the terbutaline caused the second twin to have autism or increased the risk, or whether, in fact, it was because the twin pairs that both had autism were threatening to be born too early, because that's the only reason to give them terbutaline. So is the terbutaline causing the effect, or are the twins who are the most affected with autism being selected because of threatening to come too early?
Is what you're saying that the terbutaline preserved the pregnancy that would otherwise have been lost?
That's what it's given for.
Yeah, I understand that.
Right.
But that's then these twins are born, but had they not been given terbutaline, they might not have survived long enough
right.
to be diagnosed with autism.
Right. And this there's a I can give you an example from a paper that just appeared a few weeks ago in Pediatrics of this same problem. And that is, it was noted in this paper that children with very low birth rates have a higher rate of autism than children with normal birth weights. And that might mean that being born with a very low birth weight causes autism. It also could mean that an embryo that and fetus that has autism is already injured, and so it will have a smaller weight at birth. So you can't separate the two. And that's the trouble with the terbutaline study, so that's why I didn't include it.
That low birth weight study that you've referred to, has that been filed as an exhibit by either side?
No, it just came out a few weeks ago, so.
And does that study account for the length of gestation? I mean, is it low birth weight in children carried to term, or is it low birth weight because they were born early?
Actually, it's in low birth weights because they were born early.
Doctor, the petitioners have discussed a terbutaline rat study. It's the Zarate study at Petitioner's Master List number 106. Have you ever looked at that study?
I've really just glanced at it.
And that study, weren't those rats given terbutaline postnatally?
Yes.
Would that be comparable to a postnatal exposure in humans?
No, because they were given the terbutaline when they had just been born as neonates. And rats are born very immature compared to humans. You may know that their eyes haven't opened, their ears haven't opened. They have no hair. They're bare little red things. And so, in fact, the period when they gave the terbutaline to those animals would correspond to late gestation in the human.
And so in humans who are exposed to terbutaline, is that a prenatal exposure or a postnatal exposure?
Prenatal.
Doctor, have you studied brain samples from autistic individuals?
Yes.
What did you find in your study? And we're now looking at slide 10.
I found many things, but and I can tell you about those if you like, but I wanted to give you some examples of how histology can sometimes give us information about when an injury occurred, as well as showing us the pathology itself. And this is from one of our studies at Rochester. On the left, you see a control brain. And do I have a pointer? Would you mind if I just went over and stood by this screen? Can you see if I did that?
Not at all. Please do. The problem is that I don't know if the microphone's going to pick you up.
Used to talking to a class of about 300 people. I think I can.
All right, let's see if it works.
Make myself heard. Okay, in the control brain, what we're looking at is views of the facial nucleus, and this is the part of the brain that controls the muscles of facial expression. So smiling, closing your eyes, etc. And in the case of autism that we examined, that child had lack of facial mobility. And we looked at the facial nucleus to see if it were normal. And when you look at the control nucleus, what I want you to see is these black dots. Those are the motor neurons for the face. There are about 120 of them in this picture. Okay. In the autistic case, there's only one at this level. But we counted the whole nucleus, and there were about 4,000 in this control case, and there were about 400, a little less than 400, in the case with autism. But what I want you to see is the indication that this nucleus never existed rather than having formed and then died in the person with autism. And that here's what shows you that. This nucleus is defined not just by these big cells, but by the fibers that surround it. And in the center, it's very pale, almost lucent. And these fibers that are staining darkly are fibers going up toward the rest of the brain or coming down toward the spinal cord. And when those fibers are making their way along this route, if there's anything already present, they respect the boundaries of things like the facial nucleus. So they go around it, and we describe that as being a capsule, that the nucleus is surrounded by fibers. Okay? If you look at the case of with autism, in fact, there is no capsule and there is no lucent area where the nucleus should have been. Instead, if I could have the next slide back. Instead, what you can see is that those dark staining fibers are just running willy-nilly through this area. So that suggests that when they got to this region, instead of going around the nucleus, they just went any which way, because there was no nucleus there. And the facial nucleus forms very early, like the fourth and fifth week of life. And so it would have to have been present when these tracks formed, if it existed, but it didn't.
And doctor, is this kind of finding consistent with other neuropathological findings reported by other researchers?
Yes, and Dr. Kemper talked yesterday about the case of lack of dying off in the inferior olive. So I'm not going to cover that, but I will tell you another example of something in histology that suggests that autism begins early.
Okay, and we're now looking at slide 12.
Yes. The Purkinje cells are the huge gray cells that you see here, and they have very bright nuclei with a little dot that's their nucleus. Those are the giant cells of the cerebellum. They're actually so big that you can look at a slide and you can see them with the naked eye. You don't have to put it under the microscope. And those cells are characterized by being surrounded by axons of neighboring cells. And the black deposit that you see is an immunocytochemical stain for neurofilaments in those axons. And these axons actually form a basket that extends all the way around the Purkinje cell. And you can see them depicted here. As you might imagine, if one of these cells died at some time shortly before we took this histological sample, it would leave an empty basket. And so pathologists have long looked for empty baskets in cases where the Purkinje cells may have degenerated to find out whether they died recently or whether they were lost earlier or never formed at all. And in Bailey's study, he tried to find empty baskets, and he couldn't find any, suggesting that the Purkinje cells weren't being lost at the present time.
Okay. Because in his study, are the baskets full? Is that...
The baskets are all full.
Okay. Meaning
he couldn't
that,
find any empty ones.
Meaning that the Purkinje cells had died a long time before.
Right.
Doctor, do some autistic patients have craniofacial dysmorphologies?
They do, and I have a paper on that that I mentioned in the report. But many other people have shown this, that the rate of small, minor physical malformations is increased in people with autism.
Can you give us some examples? And we're now looking at slide 13.
Sure. I want you to look at the embryo. And this is a picture of an embryo at 54 days. So that's like in the eighth week post-conception. And I want you to look at the ears. Can you see that the ears are down here on his neck? Okay, that's where the ears form. And then through differential growth, as the embryo gets older, the ears go from this position and twist so that they're upright, not lying on their sides, but upright, and they move up to the position related to the eye. And in the next picture, you'll see a typical physical malformation that's common in autism.
And this is slide 14.
Right. And it's called low-set posteriorly rotated ears, which describes the condition pretty directly. And these low-set posteriorly rotated ears obviously did not occur postnatally. In fact, the ears are in place by around the 12th week. So any problem where you see low-set posteriorly rotated ears suggests that there was an insult to development in the embryo.
And is there another example of a dysmorphism?
Yes, I put in a slide of another one. And I'm taking you back to the embryo again. And this time I want you to look at how far apart the eyes are. The human face, and actually other animals' faces, form in such a way that it's as though the face is coming together in the middle. So the middle part is produced first, but then the rest of it comes to join the middle. And what you see in cases of autism, pretty commonly, is that the eyes are too far apart. So these two little boys both have autism subsequent to exposure to valproic acid. And can you see that their eyes are just a little too far apart? That's called hypertelorism. And you can see it even more clearly if you look at how far apart their eyebrows are. In fact, they look a little bit more like the embryo I just showed you than like a normal postnatal human. That the fact that their eyes aren't close enough together leaves them with a wide, flat nasal bridge and makes you wonder whether they could ever wear glasses or not because their nasal bridge is so wide. And these cases are a good example of the fact that physical malformations, small ones, are not just associated with genetic syndromes. They occur in children like this who have a cause of autism that's environmental.
Now, Doctor, you've discussed several factors that lead you to believe that environmental factors, to the extent they play a role in autism, are occurring early in gestation. And now the issue in this litigation is regressive autism, and I was wondering if you could comment on whether you think that the evidence you've presented is inconsistent with regression in autism.
No, actually, it's well known in neuroscience that very early lesions of the nervous system often result in regression.
And why is that?
It is believed to be because if you look at behavior in very young animals or people, the big study was done in monkeys, you can find behaviors that won't occur for some time after birth. There are tests you can do that you'll find that infants do very badly at them. But as their brain matures, they're able to do those tasks. Okay? So what has been done in the primate literature is to place lesions in these very late maturing parts of the nervous system in a neonatal animal. And then when you compare that animal to a control, they both do poorly at the difficult task. They look just alike. But with the one I am referring to, when the animals get to be about 2 years old, the controls suddenly are able to do the task with ease. But the lesioned animals not only do not do as well as the normal control animals, they do worse than they did earlier in life. So it's as though that's a regression. Okay? And the reason is thought to be that when the animal reaches the age when this very advanced part of the nervous system is supposed to come online, and you can see that it has in the controls, when they reach that age, apparently they can't re-access the part of the brain they were using to do the task before. That is, they need to switch to the new system also, but they can't because it's missing. It's been ablated. So I mean, people who are familiar with early brain injuries know that regression can follow an early injury.
Doctor, based on your knowledge, training, and experience, do you believe that the evidence supports the claim that thimerosal-containing vaccines cause or contribute to autistic spectrum disorders?
I do not.
And can you briefly just summarize again the basis for that opinion?
First of all,
now we're on slide 17.
Yes, Special Master.
I mean, I believe that for many other reasons, but the information I wanted to bring to you is just that there is no similarity between the symptoms of any kind of mercury poisoning and autism, and there's not anything like a similarity between autism and ethyl mercury poisoning. And then it's my belief that the available evidence, both from known risk factors and histology and dysmorphology, indicates that autism arises in the embryo in the first trimester of pregnancy. And there's no evidence that it arises postnatally.
And, Doctor, do you hold your opinions to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty?
Yes.
Thank you. I have no further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. The petitioners have questions for this witness?
We will. Special Master, could we do a quick five-minute break here between direct and cross and then be ready in 5 minutes?
All right. Let's take a five-minute break.
Thank you.